Welcome to the Arbor Research and Trading and Bianco Research Conference Call. Your host for today's call is Mr. Jim Bianco, President of Bianco Research. Operator assistance is available at any time during this conference by pressing star zero. A question and answer session will follow the presentation. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Jim Bianco. Mr. Bianco, you may begin.
Thank you, Jean, and good morning. Welcome to everybody on our monthly conference call. Today's topic is explaining low volatility and liquidity. But first, let me go through a quick bit of housekeeping. There is a handout. I assume that you all have downloaded the handout or at least have it up on your screen. If not, you can send an email to Greg Blaha in our office, and he can immediately turn around and shoot you a copy of it. That's G-B-L-A-H-A, G-B-L-A-H-A, at biancoresearch.com. Okay, understanding low volatility and liquidity. I've got three sections in the handout. For the first couple of pages, I want to go through and I want to explain some of the causes and rationales for why we have low volatility. Then I wanted to go through a little bit of the results of what low volatility means. And then I want to circle back to something we wrote a couple of weeks ago, which I think is critical in this environment and has been for years, but nobody really wants to talk about it. And we dubbed it the original conundrum and the change in the stock-bond relationship that we've seen over the last several years, that what we've learned in business school, that lower interest rates are bullish for equities and higher interest rates are bearish, has not been the case for the last almost decade now. And while we all love to talk about conundrums, this seems to be the one that we don't want to talk about, or we just say, well, what's happened over the last umpteen years is a divergence, and it will eventually go back to the way it was. So let me start on page two and talk a little bit about volatility. Low volatility everywhere. Let me be specific on the measure of volatility that we're using. The measure of volatility we're using is implied volatility. That is a forward-looking measure of volatility, what the market expects volatility to be, not historical volatility, which is a backward-looking measure of what it has recently been. The chart here on page two shows in the top in blue stock market volatility, the VIX. In red in the middle is bond market volatility, or the MOVE, the Merrill Option Volatility Estimate. And in green and in orange on the bottom is currency volatility, both the euro and the yen. Now, what's interesting about volatility is we all know that in a crisis, Wall Street has the old saw that all volatilities, all correlations go to one. And in a crisis, it's not unusual to see all volatilities extremely high at the same time. We saw that in 1998. We saw that in 2001. 1998 during the long-term capital crisis, 2001 during September 11th. What is unusual is to have all volatilities extremely low at the same time. In fact, it's almost unprecedented that we've seen it as we do here. As you can see, the stock market, the bond market, euro, and yen volatility are all at multi-year lows at the same time. That's what's different in this environment. So page three. Excess liquidity does not drive volatility, or you could substitute the word financial liquidity does not substitute volatility. There is a misunderstanding in the markets that we sometimes interchange the words return and volatility as if they mean the same things, and a lot of times they don't. And this liquidity argument is a great example of that. In standard or the classical definition of liquidity, it would be defined as a market's ability to absorb flows without a change in price. How much can we transact at the current bid offer before we have to change the bid offer, and then how much do we have to change it by, and how much can we transact at that level? The more we can transact at the current bid offer without changing it, the more volatility we have. So by that classic definition of volatility, the more liquidity you have, the more the market can absorb flows, the more that should lead to stable to lower volatility. This is why we associate the word liquidity with lower volatility. However, that is not what everybody is talking about when they say liquidity. They mean something different, which we will dub financial liquidity. They mean either, as we have here on these charts, one of the more least controversial measures of financial liquidity. Mutual fund flows, they mean bank reserve assets, they mean M2, they mean other measures of financial liquidity. And that somehow that financial liquidity is leading to lower volatility. The chart here on the right in the upper chart is the 12-month rolling cash flows into stock funds and the VIX index. The bottom is 12-month rolling cash flows into bond funds and the VIX and the MOVE index. Excuse me. So stocks in the bottom, bonds in the stocks in the top, bonds in the bottom. And what it shows is no correlation between the measure of implied volatility and financial liquidity. So this whole argument of why is volatility low, most people you ask, they'll just say liquidity. I think they mean financial liquidity. That is not indeed the historically been the case that financial liquidity drives volatility. In fact, if you look at the late 90s in or mid to late 90s in stocks on the top, or if you look at 2001 to 2003 with bonds in the bottom, you'll see exactly the opposite. The greatest inflows produce the highest volatility or high volatility in both bonds and in stocks. And why is that? Because financial liquidity is a double-edged sword. It is not. It's sometimes when it comes into the market, it's perceived as an event, as a catalyst to lower volatility. Sometimes if too much of it comes into the market, it's perceived as distorting fundamentals or distorting markets, which raises fears in the market, which increases volatility. So in talking about why there is low volatility in the market, let me put to rest one of the favorite arguments about this financial liquidity. That's not the answer. That may be an answer for returns in the market, but returns and volatility, not the same thing. Page 4, investor skew in volatility. There is an investor skew in volatility or a skew. When markets go up or down, they don't mean the same thing for investors. Take the stock market. Stock market, most everybody is naturally long the stock market. The short base in the stock market is much, much smaller than the long base. Everybody wants stocks to go up. That is what they're supposed to do. Now, sometimes they don't do that, but the reason that we all own $17 trillion worth of stocks is we believe that those are investments that will appreciate in value. So when the stock market rises, volatility tends to fall. When the stock market declines, volatility tends to rise. The investor skew in volatility. The market does not treat rises and falls the same way. That you can see in the top chart on the right. Red line is the S&P 500. It is plotted inversely. The blue line is the VIX, so you can see that rising stock prices would be a falling red line, and that corresponds to a falling VIX index. Bottom chart is the blue line there is the volatility measure for the MOVE index, the bond market's measure of volatility, and the red line on that chart on the bottom is the yield curve. The investor skew, if you will, in the bond market is not with the absolute level of interest rates. There actually isn't really an investor skew there, but it is more with the yield curve. A flatter yield curve, all things being equal, should produce lower volatility. And a flatter yield curve is a sign that the market is not demanding a premium for longer-dated securities or longer duration, which means that the market is a little bit more comfortable with the current situation. So all things being equal, it should demand lower volatility. A steeper yield curve, it would demand higher volatility. Take that to its extreme, and you can see that on the left on this chart in 1998, when you have a crisis, typically the yield curve expands greatly, blows out like it did there in 1998, and so does bond market volatility. So when a crisis hits, typically the stock market goes down, stock volatility rises, typically the yield curve steepens, and bond market volatility rises. So one of the things that's causing low volatility in both stocks and bonds at the same time is we are in a unique situation where we have the stock market rallying in an inverted yield curve environment. Now, normally this doesn't happen. An inverted yield curve is one of those perfect indicators, until now at least, I think, that predicts a recession. An inverted yield curve is one of the few times that the market rings the bell and it tells you that there's a problem. At least that's the way people perceive it. And so, therefore, in the past, when the yield curve was inverted, that was not a time to be looking for the stock market to be going 216 days without a 2% correction, exactly as it's been doing now throughout the entire inverted yield curve environment. And so we've got this unique situation of a rallying stock market in an inverted yield curve environment. Rallying stocks produces low stock volatility because of the investor skew. An inverted yield curve keeps bond market volatility low because of the investor skew. So that is contributing to low volatility. The next thing on page 5 might be the most important reason for low volatility. Central banks offer perfect clarity. If you look at currency volatility, currencies are dominated, the thinking in currencies should be dominated by short-term forward rates of two different countries. If they, along the way, one or more of the central banks were to offer us perfect clarity about where short-term interest rates are going and when they're going to go there and how much they're going to move once they get there, that should definitely reduce volatility across the board in short-term interest rates, which would have an immediate impact on currencies. And by the way, currencies do not have an investor skew, as we talked about in the previous page. The chart here on the right shows, at least measuring by the Fed fund, measuring the Federal Reserve, because we have measures of that, how good that they have been doing with their clarity. The red line on the chart there shows you the actual 3-month change in the federal funds rate. The blue line and the target federal funds rate, what did it actually change by over the previous 3 months, either up or down? The blue line on that chart is what the Fed fund futures expected the change to be over the next 3 months, 3 months ago. So looking at what did the Fed fund futures predict would be the change over the next 3 months, what actually was the change over that 3-month period, and the bottom chart plots the difference between the two. And you can see that starting in June of 2003, that difference has been hovering very close to around zero. The clarity that we have in the Federal Reserve in short-term interest rates starting in June of 2003 is clearer than we have ever seen. Now, what happened in 2003? The simple answer is the Fed moved to forward-looking statements. The first one was considerable period, then there was patience, and finally there was measured. The Greenspan Fed back then left no doubt as to what they were doing, and we knew exactly when they were going to raise rates. We knew to the minute that it was going to be about 2:15 Central, give or take 90 seconds, would be the announcement that they were either going to raise rates or they were not going to raise rates. And that continues through to this day, which is why you can see that the difference there is very low. So what else is contributing to lower volatility? Perfect clarity from the Federal Reserve. Add to that, you're getting increasing clarity from the BOJ and the ECB as well, too. Now, they are not quite to the level of the Fed, but they are becoming more and more clear. Removing uncertainty about short-term interest rates will also help to lower currency volatility and, to some extent, flatten the yield curve, which will help to lower bond market volatility. Finally, page 6, as far as why volatility is getting lower. The derivatives market has been with us now for about 30 years. And when you say derivatives markets, most people, the first thought that they think of is the market that blows up every 5 or 7 years and has some spectacular disaster, starting in 87 with mortgages, ending in 98 with long-term capital. Along the way, we have the 1994 debacle, the 1997 Asian financial crisis, and on and on. So there is a long and illustrious history of the derivatives market having problems. But let's remember what the derivatives market was supposed to be. It is supposed to be a risk transfer market. It's supposed to be an insurance market, a place where we can go and take a certain risk and insure against it. If the derivatives market is working properly, it should also serve to reduce volatility. Volatility, implied volatility, is the price you pay for insurance for uncertainty in the future. if there are certain things that I am uncertain about in the future that I can remove from the equation through a derivatives transaction, all things being equal, that should also serve to lower volatility as well. Now, the charts on the right show, let me start with the chart on the upper right, total notional value of derivatives outstanding. It has been growing. This is the total size of the derivatives market by two measures. The banking data measure, which is about $125 trillion notional value, and the ISDA data, the Swap Dealers Association data, which is about $250 trillion notional value. These are numbers that are hard to understand when you start getting up to $250 trillion. The bottom chart on the right shows the concentration of derivatives. The OCC data, $125 trillion, three dealers, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and Bank of America, are 90% of that total. Everybody else, and there's like 520 other banks that report derivatives, are 10% of that total. So it's a highly concentrated business, with J.P. Morgan being fully half that total. So J.P. Morgan is 12% of the world derivatives market, 25% of the U.S. domestic derivatives market. J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and Bank of America are 90% of the domestic derivatives market, about 45% of the world derivatives market as well, too. So this market is highly, highly concentrated. Now, a lot of people look at this and they say, this is a problem because if one of these three dealers were to have a problem, it would have serious and immediate ramifications for the entire derivatives market. This is absolutely true. However, there's a flip side to that argument. And the flip side to that argument is, by having the market so concentrated, it does force some transparency on this market. Part of the problem with derivatives that we've had in the past has been secondary and tertiary dealers operating in the dark, people not really knowing what was happening until the market exploded, and then we started to learn the names of the players and what they did all at that time. By having a concentration, we do tend to put more transparency and therefore more stability on the derivatives market. Now, let me be clear about one thing here about derivatives. I am talking about a systemic-wide problem and the possibility of a systemic-wide problem, and I think it's been reduced. That does not mean that you can't have local problems. We have had problems all along the way. CPDOs have given the credit markets problems. Subprime mortgages are giving problems in the market now, and those sectors will have problems. There will be losses. There will be gains in those sectors. There might be irrational pricing. The question is, will these always remain localized affairs, or will that mushroom into something much larger? And I would argue that because of the concentration and the clarity, they are more likely to stay localized affairs, CPDO. There was a lot of hand-wringing about that new product last fall, that it was going to cause all kind of problems. It did for dealers and CPDOs, but nobody else. So if you did not deal in that product, it was kind of a non-issue for you. Subprime mortgages. There is a lot of talk today, literally today, that it will mushroom into something larger than just meaning that a couple of subprime lenders are going to have problems. I would argue, yes, the subprime lenders are going to have problems, but for the moment, I don't think that's going to go much beyond the subprime lenders. We've seen this story over and over again. Charts on the left. Top chart, credit derivatives. Credit derivatives, a natural extension of equity derivatives, equity options, have added to the plate of options from the derivatives market. Now we've added operational risk among companies or groups of companies, CDXs, groups of companies, that we could now, if we believe that that is a risk that would raise volatility, we now have instruments that we can get rid of it. We've seen the total notional value of credit derivatives held by all depository institutions rise. That's the top chart on the left, that it's measured as how big is credit derivatives held by banks as a percentage of the size of the bond market. It's multiple times the size of the bond market. The bottom chart shows the net protection owned by banks as a percentage of loans and leases. Could have showed you some number that measures in trillions, but I thought as a size of their loan portfolios, it would be a better measure. Notice what happened by the first quarter of 2005. That's when GM and Ford defaulted. The banking system was largely a net buyer of protection. That the banking system was using protection as a one-way market. It was using protection as we would protect against our loan portfolio by buying protection. After the GM and Ford default, those numbers went more into balance. Now, the growth, as the top chart shows, didn't go away. It's just that they balanced themselves off and played the market more in a two-way type of fashion. Again, this adds, I think, more stability to a market. Another problem that derivatives markets have, especially listed futures and options, is all of the deep liquid players are on one side of the market. Thinly margined speculators take the other side because nobody else will. And when you get into that problem of thinly margined speculators losing money, they cannot withstand losses, and then the market starts to get irrational. Here we have deep liquid players on both sides of the market because of the balance in derivatives. And because we have deep liquid players on both sides of the market, it is a lot more stable. So why is volatility so low across the board and everything? It's not as simple as liquidity, because we don't mean what the classic definition is. I think we mean financial liquidity. That doesn't correlate to it. It is a combination, I think, of unusual market behavior in that we have a rallying stock market in an inverted yield curve environment. We have perfect clarity from the Federal Reserve, and maybe, or at least for the moment, the derivatives market is allowing us to take more and more risks and hedge away from those risks, leaving the potential pool of uncertain events to go smaller and smaller, and that also brings down volatility, which has volatility low across the board. This argument I like, because this argument now makes more sense as to what would cause volatility to go up, a reversal of any of these events. Would be a steepening yield curve, a declining stock market, or if there is an event, a geopolitical event or a financial event, the question you need to ask yourself is, because I know a lot of people ask these questions, when there's war in Lebanon, when crude oil goes to $77 and then goes to $50, why isn't this affecting volatility? The answer is, does it cause the yield curve to steepen? Should it cause the stock market to go down? Should it cause the Fed to become less transparent? Should it cause the derivatives market to now realize that there's a risk that we don't have a product for? Most of the time, all of those events that everybody thinks should raise volatility, the answer is no to all those questions. That's why volatility doesn't go up. So, steepening yield curve, declining stock prices, less clarity from central banks, or a risk that we don't have a derivatives for, or the unforeseen event that a problem in subprimes or something else does look more systemic than localized. That would raise volatility. But unless or until we have those events, and we are not now, I don't think volatility is going to go up, and it's going to stay lower. So what does it mean? Page 8, at least for some arguments about what volatility allows us to do. Lower volatility, the perceptions of volatility is going to stay low, is allowing the marketplace to increase its leverage. The chart in the upper right, a levered bull market, overnight repo as a percentage of the market value of the Merrill Domestic Master Index is going and going and going. Right now, overnight repo is one quarter the size of the bond market. Back when long-term capital was being unwound, it was somewhere around 10% the size, so it's 2.5 times larger than it has been in the past. Is everybody being reckless? I know that that's a favorite argument. Yeah, maybe there is some recklessness in there. But it's also the natural response to a less volatile market, a market where we believe that most of the risks, we have tools that we can actually transfer those risks to somebody who actively wants to take those risks and not bear them unnecessarily. So it makes sense that we would see that. The chart below that, 10-year and Treasury bond futures as a percentage of outstanding open interest, has been rising as well, too. You can see those leverage statistics are going up. Finally, the chart in the upper left, leverage in the primary dealer positions. Primary dealer The size of primary dealer proprietary trading operations is about $1.3 trillion, up from about $250 or $300 billion in 2000. And finally, the stock market, which is also listed on that chart in the upper left, stock market debt is approaching its 2000 high. And you can see from the chart below, the blue lines on the chart in the lower left is the S&P 500, and the red line is NYSE margin debt as a percentage of stock market capitalization. It's getting near the levels of 2000, which is also very close to the levels of the mid-80s, at around 1.5, 1.6%. Volatility, lower volatility, is allowing more leverage in the market. Now, until we get a reversal in the yield curve, stock prices, or the derivatives market, or clarity in the Fed, these numbers will probably stay this way and continue to expand. That's why I should also parenthetically add that a lot of the risks that I think we see in the marketplace, why Trichet's comments about the yen carry trade are falling on deaf ears, because the only thing that would upset, I think, the yen carry trade more than anything else at this point is if the Bank of Japan were to operate in a period where we can't see what they're doing. And that has not been the case. The Bank of Japan under Fukui is actually trying to create more liquidity, not reduce liquidity. Page 8. Another thing that's happening with lower volatility is it's narrowing the range of possibilities. Last week in the Wall Street Journal, there was a story that the Morgan Stanley Capital stock sectors, the range from the highest to the lowest stock sectors, has been the smallest we've seen in 20 years. We had a similar chart. We put this out earlier this week where we look at asset classes. Here we have, if you look at the table, we have the 12-month returns for three-month bills. We have the 12-month returns for the S&P 500, six different stock markets, and six different bond markets, total 15 different markets. The chart on the right plots the highest returning market, the lowest returning market, and the panel below it plots the difference between the two. And what you see is we're down near 30%. Now, yes, there is some mean reversion in this, in that we expect that we won't stay at these low levels for very long, and we could see some mean reversion as we move forward from here. Nevertheless, one of the reasons why we're seeing a narrowing range of possibilities has been lower volatility. Now, on page 9, page 9, I want to talk a little bit about one other thing that's been happening along the way, which I think is contributing to the lower volatility, and that it is contributing to the inverted yield curve with rising stock prices. The interest rate to stock relationship conundrum has changed. Here's a 60-plus year chart on page 9. Top panel is the S&P 500. The bottom panel is 10-year notes. And the middle panel is 10-year notes. And the bottom in red is a rolling 5-year correlation between stocks and bonds. And what we have is we have a positive correlation between stocks and bonds to a degree we have never seen before. Rising stock prices tend to bring about higher yields. Lower stock prices tend to bring about lower yields. This has been going on now since the late 80s. This is 90s, excuse me. This has been going on for almost 10 years. Every other time we seem to have markets that diverge from what we think they should trade for more than 2 weeks, we call it a divergence. We have big stories in the Financial Times about what it means. This has been going on for 10 years. There is no big story in the Financial Times about what it means. If this is ever addressed, it's addressed in reaction that this is a divergence. This is a temporary situation that will soon correct itself. Or, as I've recently commented on in our News Clips product in the last couple of weeks, there's been some people that don't even think it's existed, that still lower yields should bring about higher stock prices and higher yields should bring about lower stock prices, that idea is still there in the marketplace. But obviously something has changed, and something has changed with the way that stocks and bonds relate to each other, which I think is contributing to a rallying market with an inverted curve. Chart on page 10. One of the big changes that started around 1997, 1998, and that's that green vertical line on the chart, this is stock market cap as percent of GDP, is the stock market's size became larger than the economy. Now, I know this chart we've used for over a decade, and I know I'm mixing apples and oranges here. I'm looking at a level concept in the stock market with a flow concept in GDP, but it's really no different than what the P/E ratio is. That also mixes a level concept and a flow concept in prices versus earnings as well too. So we do this in the marketplace, and this is a variation on that theme. And what it shows is that the stock market's wealth, the size of the stock market, is larger than the production of the economy, and that we have argued that that has created a wealth effect that continues to this day. I know it was a hot topic in the late 90s, and it went away. I would argue it actually never really did go away. That is that the stock market is no longer a reflection of the economy. It's a driver of the economy. Strong stock prices, and if you look at the charts on page 11, strong stock prices produce wealth. They produce capital gains. That's why if you look at the top chart, I've got that same line there around December of 98. I do believe there was a paradigm shift that took place, that since December of 98, we've had a high degree of correlation between the budget deficit and the stock market. Stock market is so big that when it rallies, it produces capital gains, it produces higher asset valuations, it produces revenue for the Treasury. So in a rallying stock market, we see the budget deficit narrowing. In a declining stock market, we see the budget deficit widening. Of course, all things being equal, Congress can also go out and spend money like drunken sailors, or they could shock us all and show some frugality in not spending, and that can change the equation. But even with that, it does seem that the stock market's influence on the economy is now greater than it's ever been. It is a driver of the budget deficit right now. The chart below it, we have also argued that it is a driver of consumer confidence as well, too, in that when the stock market – the problem we've argued with consumer confidence is when people are asked, what do you think of the economy, it's too abstract a question. They don't understand the question. Nobody understands. It's like asking, what is the weather in the United States? Well, it's cold in some places and warm in other places. So when you're faced with a large abstract question, you tend to kind of localize it into something you can understand. So when people ask you, what is the weather of the United States, you look out the window. If you're in Chicago like I am, you say it's 7 degrees and there's snow on the ground. If you're asked, what is the state of the economy, it's too abstract a question. So you say to yourself, well, the stock market has been rallying, so I think it's been pretty good. And that's why we've argued that there's no it's not a coincidence that the stock market, since about 97, 98, when it's gotten to 100% the size of the economy, has been highly correlated with consumer confidence. Furthermore, I didn't show this chart, but in the piece we put out about this a couple of weeks ago, we also show that it was highly correlated as well to the jobs plentiful index. Again, I don't think people understand the question. They don't know whether or not jobs are plentiful or not. The answer is no if you're looking for a job, yes if you just got a job, and you don't know if you're not in the job market, which 95% of the people are not in the job market because the unemployment rate is only 5%. So they tend to key it off the stock market too. It is also highly correlated. Floyd Norris had a thing on his blog a few weeks ago talking about how the jobs plentiful index is so high, but everybody you ask that's in the jobs market says it's not nearly that good. That's because it's being dominated by, I think, the stock market. Of course, the stock market, the S&P 500, and consumer confidence are two of the 10 indicators in the index of leading economic indicators. The yield curve is also in there, too. And if you believe that rising stock prices brings about higher yields and lowering stock prices brings about lower yields, then it starts to make a little bit more sense that why we can have an inverted yield curve with rallying stocks because of the influence the stock market has on the yield curve. That's a third indicator in the LEI. The LEI is being more and more dominated, the idea of leading economic indicators being more and more dominated by the stock market as we go on from here. Finally, on page 12, I want to just repeat one other liquidity argument, which is only now starting to get some press. And I think it's important to understand because there's this idea about liquidity, and really what I've argued here is that it's more the low volatility is more about risk-taking. And the risk-taking is because there's the investor skew is going in our way, high stock prices, an inverted yield curve. The risks that we see are getting defined away left and right. The Federal Reserve used to be a risk. They're no longer a risk. We know what they're going to do. The BOJ, ECB used to be a risk. They're less of a risk. We've got a pretty good idea of what they're going to do. There's all these other risks out there. There's interest rate risk, currency risk, macro risks. There's derivative products that we can now use to reduce those risks. Finally, there used to be company operational risk. Well, now we've got the credit default swap market, so I could now hedge away company operational risk. What does that leave me left as far as unknown risks? A much smaller pool, and that's why volatility is down and should stay down. That's why leverage is higher, and with the larger stock market, it's exacerbating this idea. The last thing I want to talk about with liquidity is when people also mean financial liquidity, I don't think they mean it from the demand side, that everybody's throwing money at everything. I also think that there's part of a supply side argument that they're missing. What's amazing about the stock market right now, and a lot of people don't realize this, is this chart here. The blue lines on this chart are flows into domestic equity mutual funds in the top chart, and on the bottom chart, top chart's monthly flows, the bottom chart is a rolling 12-month sum. The red line is international flows. There's no money going into equity mutual funds. The stock market has gone, as we show, well, you can see the bars, only $12 billion has gone into equity mutual funds over the last year. There's been an outflow in equity mutual funds of $27.88 billion since May, an outflow in domestic equity mutual funds of $27 billion since May. If you turn to page 13, there's our favorite chart there of the longest periods without a 2% correction. We're about to go the longest period without in 50 years without a 2% correction. The market is up 18.5% over that period. And what has the public done during that historic rally? They have sold. They have liquidated throughout this entire rally. They are not participating in this rally. Their equity mutual funds, as the bottom chart shows, is 24% of the market. They're not participating. How can the market go up 200 days without a 2% correction if the far and away the largest sector of the market is not participating? And some people would argue on page 14 that it's ETFs. Well, here's some of the numbers on ETFs. They're $425 billion. Their flows are still less than $10 billion. Yes, they've gotten some flows. Since May, they've gotten $53 billion of flows. If you add them to the mix, you've got $19 billion between ETFs and between open-ended mutual funds that have put money into the domestic equity stock market. Since May, $20 billion. We did that in a week or so in 2000. Now it's taken 7 months. That still does not explain why the market's gone up 200 days without a 2% correction. And I would argue that it's the chart on page 15 that the stock market has been collapsing itself in size to a degree that we've never seen. It's been a supply-driven rally. It's not been a demand-driven rally. The combination of Sarbanes-Oxley dissuading IPOs and secondary offerings, plus the huge inflows into private equities, the lowering capital gains to encourage stock buybacks, has meant that we've been shrinking the stock market on a year-over-year basis at around $400 billion through the third quarter. The per annum pace for the third quarter was $560 billion. That's about 4% the size of the stock market is disappearing every year. This is far and away larger than any of the biggest flows, demand flows, that we saw in the late 90s coming into mutual funds. So really, when we also talk about liquidity, we tend to look at the demand side of liquidity. How much money is the Federal Reserve creating? How much money are investors throwing into the market? In terms of the largest capital market, the U.S. equity market, it is more of a supply-driven story. So, in conclusion, volatility is low. There's lots of reasons why volatility is low. One of them is not the liquidity argument. The reason that I think it's important to understand the argument is because those are the questions you have to ask yourself as to whether volatility is going to rise. Is an event happens, people think it should rise in volatility. Question is, should this event produce a steepening of the yield curve? The best way to steepen the yield curve would be, will the Fed, which is perceived to be on hold, now view an event? So if the Fed is perceived to be on hold and we have perfect clarity with the Fed, we need an event to happen that's going to make the Fed abandon that strategy and start cutting rates immediately. If we don't have that strategy, that's not going to produce a steeper curve. Bond market volatility should go up. Should the event produce an immediate rethink on earnings and the fundamentals of the stock market, maybe not individual stocks, but the stock market? If the answer is no, we should not see a rise in equity market volatility. Should that event produce such an unanticipated surprise in the derivatives market that a problem that might start in somewhere like subprime mushroom larger into the entire market into a systemic wide problem? If the answer there is no, then we don't expect to see a rise in volatility, and the answer has largely been no on all of these. In conclusion, since 2002, we have had lots of stories running around the market that has gotten everybody to wring their hands and say, this is it, we're all going to die. We had deflation in 2002. In 2003, we had the Iraq War. In 2004, we had pension buying. We had the Fed unmeasured. In 2005, we had crude oil topping $50 on its way to $70. In 2006, we had the emerging markets blow up, which was my personal favorite, that all of the policemen in India were called back from leave and were put on double duty around the canals and lakes because they were looking for stockbrokers to commit suicide by drowning themselves. 4 months later, the Indian stock market was at new all-time highs. Now we've got the yen carry trade because the yen's above 120. We've got subprime mortgages being problems. Maybe these are the ones that will lead to a systemic-wide problem. That may happen again someday. My point is, it looks more to me like the next in a very long line of worries that turn out to be localized issues for a couple of stocks in a small market, but not a systemic-wide issue for everybody else. Let me stop there. Let me thank everybody for joining us on our conference call. Let me ask Gene, the operator, to come back and give you instructions on how to ask questions. Gene, are you there?
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will conduct the question and answer session. If you would like to state a question, please press star 1 on your phone now, and you will be placed in the queue in the order received, or press pound at any time to remove yourself from the queue. Please listen for your first name only to be announced and be prepared to ask your question when prompted. We are now ready to begin. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now.
Gene, let me before you jump in there, let me also mention that, just to reiterate, first name only, because we like to encourage questions so you can remain some anonymity. And second of all, sometimes people like to email me questions. So if you want to drop me JBianco at Bianco Research a note, I could take them that way as well, too. Gene, do we have any questions?
Our first question comes from Richard. Please state your question.
Yeah, my question is, as you travel around and talk to portfolio managers and hedge fund managers, et cetera, What kickback do you get of different theories, of other alternative theories of why the positive correlation has evolved, and what's your evaluation of these alternative theories?
Usually the alternative theories will revolve around two major stories. That would be Asian central bank buying Asian central bank reserves, which again is in the paper today, and it would be in the revolving recycling of petrodollars, that we're sending all of our money to OPEC, and OPEC is turning around and they're buying everything in sight indiscriminately, and it's raising the markets. Now, let me take the OPEC story first. The problem with that story is it implies that there should be some kind of a correlation between crude oil prices and these positive correlations or in markets, and there is not a correlation between crude oil prices and these positive markets. Second of all, if you believe the stories that we're sending $1 trillion to OPEC and they have to invest $1 trillion, that $1 trillion is coming from somewhere. There should be a downside to that story. There should be a lack of consumer spending, a hit to the economy. Somewhere, somebody's spending $1 trillion on something else, and it's getting misallocated into the financial markets, because that's essentially what we're saying, is there's a giant $1 trillion misallocation. No one can find the other side of that story, in that it's just that the money is going to OPEC, but consumers are, the extra dollars that they've spent on higher gasoline prices is not impacting the economy, but it isn't impacting the stock market. So it kind of falls apart there. Now, the Asian central bank story, the Asian central bank story, of course, is primarily China. They've got $1 trillion in reserves because of their huge current account deficit with the United States. They don't know what to do with all this money. Yet again today in the paper, and it's not new, in the Wall Street Journal again today, there's a story that they're going to start to diversify those reserves away from the traditional investments of government bonds among European and the United States. That story is not new. that story, that's why I don't think it's getting much of a reaction in the market. And second of all, the problem with the Asian financial story is that we tend to overestimate the extent of which the Chinese in particular are buying in our market. The Chinese own, according to the TIC data, $300 billion worth of treasuries, where the Japanese own $700 billion worth of treasuries. The Chinese are only about 17% of the market. And so I think that we tend to overestimate their influence on the market. It will have maybe some marginal influence on the edges, but nothing significant. But certainly nothing to the extent that it would affect the marketplace all across the board like everybody else is seeing. Those are kind of the alternate theories. Did you have a follow up to that?
No, that's fine.
Okay, thanks. Gene, do we have any other questions?
Once again, if you would like to state a question, please press *1 on your phone.
I have an email question here from Christopher. Low volatility to remain intact, does that keep your range in the 10-year intact? Yes. 2 months ago in the December conference call, we were talking about how yields would stay range-bound and probably move towards the 4.25 range. At that call, they were at 4.40, and today the yield is at 4.70. So it's 30 basis points higher over 2 months. It has snuck out as high as 4.90. Has that call been wrong? Technically, yes, but 30 basis points over 2 months is not a real painful mistake. That's my point is that's what the market is giving us right now, is a range-bound market. Still think that 4.25 is probably on the lower side of the market, but more likely, until something changes one way or the other, I do think that we're just going to meander sideways, as we have been and as we will continue to. Gene, do we have any other questions?
Yes, our next question comes from Peter. Please state your question.
Hi, Jim. You make good points about essentially the markets have been, you know, mounting a wall of worry. But it has been 4 years of a bull market in stocks and 4 years of tightening spreads, and triple C's are all-time spread tights, I believe.
Yes.
So you're not paid much to take risk. So isn't it time to pay more attention to potential potholes than less?
It's never not time to pay attention to potholes, but I guess what I'm trying to argue is let's define what we need to see. You are getting paid less now with triple C's than ever before, but you also have instruments and CDX and single company CDSs that you can remove a great deal of that risk. A lot of people are holding triple C's because the belief is, in the past, if there was a problem, these are illiquid investments and we might as well just send them right to the distress department because we can never sell them. But now, if there's the hint or inkling of a problem, there is the CDS market, which is very deep and very liquid, which gives us a myriad of possibilities to protect ourselves from losses in these instruments. That is the assumption that everybody's working on. As long as that market is there, and as long as that market is operating, I think that that is a valid assumption. Now, we can definitely be asking questions, what could come along that could cause the CDS market to just lock up and not perform that function anymore, and everybody's kind of stuck there? Well, we've had a lot of fears in that market. We've had the fear of settlement, which we've now done a great deal to try and resolve the settlement issue. We've had a fear about language in the contracts. We've standardized a lot of the language in the contracts. I'm arguing that a lot of people think the fear is that there will be losses taken indiscriminately by people that can't handle it, and that would cause a fear. That is always a possibility for a specific market, but I don't think it's going to definitely come into a market that is going to be a systemic-wide issue. Bottom line for your question, what could cause triple C's to widen? Same thing that could cause the stock market to decline. which is the traditional answer of a serious slowdown in the economy, slowing of earnings, and a reassessment of the outlook of the economy. Right now, that is not the case. You know, we're arguing whether or not we've had the 14th quarter in a row of double-digit growth. Maybe we have, maybe we haven't. We're arguing that the Fed is on hold because the economy is doing fine at 5.25. They're not going to cut rates. The stock market is continuing to make new highs without correcting 2%. So nothing out there right now suggests that that's an imminent worry. Now, something can change tomorrow to cause that, and you should always be vigilant on that, but I don't see that as being something that's evolving as we speak. Peter, did you have a follow-up to that?
Well, does the size of the leverage make you wonder about the liquidity, the true liquidity when you need it? Or does the size of the leverage and the derivatives mean that if everybody's trying to go through the exit door at the same time and counting on that because, oh, I can own triple C's now than I couldn't in the past because I can hedge them, sort of like, is there a chance that you have the portfolio insurance theory, you know, of 1987?
Yeah. If you go back to the derivatives chart that I was showing you guys on page 6, it isn't so much the size of the derivatives market as is the net position. If you look at that bottom left chart, net credit protection owned by depository institutions, I do think that you had a real risk of the portfolio insurance problem up until the first quarter of 2005, the GM downgrade. And, in fact, you might have even run a mini version of that with the GM downgrade and all the problems that you had in credit in the first quarter of 2005. Why? Because everybody was on one side of the market. The problem with portfolio insurance in 1987 wasn't the size of it or wasn't the existence of it, but everybody was using it, everybody meaning the deep liquid players were using it in the same direction, and that left an imbalanced market that couldn't handle a wave of money coming. Now, if this data is to be believed, and this is coming from the FDIC, the positions, even though they've grown in size, are more balanced, that they're almost equal, the number of banks that are on the long side as the number of banks that are on the short side. So if there is a violent movement in credit, and credit default protection widens and gets more expensive, there will be people that will take losses, but they won't all be hedge funds with $100 million and 5 employees. They will be large financial institutions that can withstand those losses, continue to make markets in that, and there will be financial institutions on the other side that will make money in that. A great example of this would be Amerith. Everybody talks about Amerith losing $6 billion, but yet the market was so deep and so two-way, there was Cerberus, I think was their name, in Houston, which claimed they made 200%, and they were on the other side of Amerith's trades, that the problem came. It was a problem for Amerith. It was a problem for their creditors and their investors, and it wasn't anything more than that. And that's where I think whenever you see a market evolving to that size, you always get worried, but if you see, as the net chart shows, that it's more two-way business, then you know you've got deep players on both sides. I actually think the more telling chart or the more interesting chart is the net chart. If that net was ever to get extreme, that is the more worrisome than the absolute size for the market.
Thanks, Jim.
Sure. Another email question from another Christopher. Does the amount of hedge fund money and their short positions make the stock market less volatile? All things being equal, I would argue, first of all, if hedge funds are doing what they're supposed to be doing, and that is they're alpha investors, meaning that they're long and short the market at the same time and that they might have a net beta exposure, that they might be net long the market or net short the market as a group, if hedge fund investors are doing what they should be doing, what they are essentially doing is they are increasing the traditional definition of liquidity, that they're allowing flows to be absorbed at a given price before we have to move bids and offers because they're on both sides of the market. That all things being equal, they should be on net reducing volatility. Now, along the way, they could be increasing it in certain sectors and increasing it in certain strategies because they're pushing one way or another too hard. Along the way, there could be problems with one or more hedge funds that can cause an increase in some portions of volatility in the market, but I don't think as a group the entire market. They are on both sides of the market at the same time, and because of that, it is less risky than say the late 90s when the public was throwing $2 or $3 billion a day long the market and were at risk to a decline in the market. In other words, with hedge funds, if the market were to decline, would they be hurt or would they be helped? The answer is we don't know because they're long and short the market at the same time. Some would be helped, others would be hurt. Gene, do we have any other questions?
Yes, our next question comes from Ian. Please state your question.
Yes, my question is, do you believe to any extent that the structure of the regulatory environment has had an impact on the ability of these instruments to reduce volatility? And therefore, is there not a risk that a change in that environment could actually cause a fairly digital change?
Regulatory change is always a big, important risk. The last part of the chart's a different regulatory change. The collapse in the size of the stock market, which, of course, over the short term is a good thing because it's helping to raise stock prices. But over the long term, the stock market is supposed to be a place to raise capital, not just to speculate with retirement money. And Sarbanes-Oxley, that regulatory change has restricted the capital-raising function of the market, leaving it to reduce its size and helping to push it up, and maybe we get to a point of overvaluation. Of course, there's other factors in there. Regulatory changes are always a very important point and a very immediate point that they can cause a lot of problems. But when Congress, in their zeal to pass Sarbanes-Oxley and make CFOs and CEOs attest statements and put all of this onerous regulation and compliance on these companies, they didn't foresee what's happening right now. And that's why you're seeing Chuck Schumer teaming up with John Thain at the New York Stock Exchange to try and help to change or possibly repeal Sarbanes-Oxley. Regulatory changes have always had the law of unintended consequences. So, yeah, I do think that there is a risk that if we decide that we need to put regulations down on these instruments and hedge funds in a very big and onerous way, that it could result in a problem. It could result in the free flow of these markets, and it could definitely backfire, as I think Sarbanes-Oxley is backfiring as we go from here. Ian, did you have a follow-up to that?
But do you think actually the actual regulatory environment has caused lower volatility? Because when you look at operators in the market now, some of those people are responsible for this process. They're operating with capital constraints that are different than the purely regulated market, and that's enabling them to do transactions that would previously not be possible.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that the hedge funds are operating with less capital constraints and they're able to do things in the marketplace right now. They are paired off, so I'm not as worried about it as I would normally be, but if we were to start to stick capital restraints or owners reporting requirements on them, they wouldn't be moving, and I think that would help, that would change the profile of volatility in the market. Does that get to your question?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. If we have one more question, I will take it. Gene, do we have one more?
At this time, there are no further audio questions.
Okay, very good. I usually don't want to run more than an hour, and we're at an hour, so let me thank everybody for joining us, and we will see you at next month's conference call. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for attending.